Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Day bombing is the bold, the aggressive, the offensive thing to do. It is the method and the practice which will put the greatest pressure on Germany, work the greatest havoc to his wartime industry, and the greatest reduction to his air force. We have built up slowly and painfully and learned our job in new theater against a tough enemy. Then we were torn down and shipped away to Africa. Now we have just built back up again and are ready for the job we all cherish. Daylight bombing of Germany. Be patient. Give us our chance and your reward will be ample. Successful day-bombing offensive to combine and conspire with the admirable night-bombing of the RAF to wreck German industry, transportation, and morale. Soften the Hun for land invasion and the kill.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was General Ira Aker there. Yes. Thanks, General.
In the case for day bombing.
Thanks, General. Very nice to have you in the studio.
I'm sure everyone's absolutely cherishing the prospect of bombing.
I mean, Cherish is doing a lot of work there. Bloody hell. So there we are. That's Ira Aker literally stating the case for day bombing on the 17th of January 1943. So if you listen to our last episode, A, thank you, and B, we hope you some of the salient points stuck with you, because we began with Schweinfurt too, the second raid on the ball bearing plant in Schweinfurt, which was a disaster, I think it's fair to say.
An absolute disaster. Charted, didn't we, the kind of development of the daylight precision bombing doctrine. And we left it just as FDR had sanctioned 50,000 aircraft a year, and the tempo of air bombing, of air power, and particularly strategic bombing campaigns were being sort of ratcheted up in the United States. But welcome to episode two of our series on the Mighty Eighth, on the United States Eighth Air Force, based in the United Kingdom during its life in the Second World War. And we should probably just very briefly talk about the kind of the birth of the Eighth Air Force and what's happened and how it comes to be in Britain. So the United States Army Air Corps becomes the United States Army Air Force in June 1941. And Tui Spots, who we mentioned earlier on, who is sort of the chief of staff to Arnold in the pre-war years, arrives in the UK on the 18th of June 1942 to take command of the newly formed US Eighth Air Force. I'm just going to let my dog in. So he's taking command, and so there's a plan for this. You know, this is very much at the heart of America's efforts. This is part of Operation Bolero, which is a build-up of U.S. forces in the United Kingdom. Starts with the 34th Red Bulls coming over, the infantry division coming over in January 1942. And this is a sort of natural extension of that, I suppose.
Yeah. What Spots has drawn the conclusion. I mean, it's very interesting, the conclusion he draws from the German switch after the battle, or the end of the Battle of Britain, into night bombing. Is he saying that their day bombing's not accurate because they haven't trained for it? He's quite right about that, because the German, it's a tactical air force, the Luftwaffe, strictly speaking. So they haven't really, although there's some argument, there is some argument about this, isn't there? That they haven't really argued for a strategic bombing campaign at all. They haven't prepared for one. And so the switch to night bombing is essentially improvised. So the bombing's not very accurate. Even when it's effective, it's kind of accidental. So his conclusion is, so we'll bomb by day because we know what we're doing. We've got the kit. We've got the mindset. And there is a sense that this is the American way of doing things too, that it suits the American mindset. It's sort of honest or something, trying to bomb by day, isn't it? You're not lurking in the shadows and all that. It's a kind of clean cut way of doing things. And it's an air force is the thing to remember about, although yes. Fighters feature later, you know, later in the story. And what's interesting is we've talked about, you said in the last episode, fighters are a defensive weapon, bombers are an offensive weapon. That actually the revolutionary thing that comes with fighters is that the Americans use escort fighters as an offensive weapon, don't they?
Yes. That's how it develops into that.
It develops into that. And that's actually the moment of revolution in their thinking is that they arrive at that, which is interesting because the final sort of pancake they flip over is that one. And that's the thing that then changes everything. It's something really, really fascinating. But not at this stage. So the fighter side of things, there is a 8th Fighter Command joins in July, but it's all really quite small beer.
Well, if you look at the makeup of the planned makeup of the 8th Air Force when it comes over to Britain and kicks off in, you know, launched and created in June 1942, the plan at that point is to build up 16 heavy bombardment groups, each with 32 bombers and three pursuit groups only of 75 to 80 fighter planes each. So each bomb group, just to reiterate, has three squadrons each. And the first units are starting to arrive that summer. But of course, you know, it doesn't take long before there's a slight detour. So it's worth saying that the 4th of July 1942, this is the first ever 8th Air Force operation. It is six Bostons, twin-engine Boston bombers of the 15th Bomb Squadron, accompanied by six aircraft of 226 Squadron RAF. And the Bostons are borrowed from the RAF anyway. And one Boston is lost on the first mission and two airmen missing in action. And the operations that are carried out in July are mainly actually the pursuit planes, the fighter planes of 8th Fighter Command with their very sort of small numbers, who are operating alongside RAF Fighter Command on little sweeps over into Europe and stuff. But the 17th of August 1942, this is the first proper mission by B-17s, American B-17s, 18 of them, all from the 97th Bomb Group, which targets Rouen in France, and there's no losses. But it's really important to stress that, you know, here we are in the middle of the war in the summer of 1942.
Yes, I know.
And, you know, the 8th Air Force is tiny. It is not mighty at all. It's the tiddly 8th Air Force at this point.
How are they getting the B-17s to Britain? They're not being shipped, are they? What are they doing? They're flying them.
They're flying them on a route that goes to sort of Greenland, Iceland.
Completely bonkers route to frozen, godforsaken stations where they come in, they refuel, they maybe have a kip, they have something to eat, and then they fly on. And very challenging runs, aren't they, these delivery runs?
Yeah, they really, really are. And there's hundreds of them eventually. I mean, thousands of them eventually. I mean, the amazing thing is after the North Africa campaign and the sort of freeing up of North Africa following the torch landings in November 1942, then they can do it a different way. They can sort of go down into the Caribbean, then they can cross over to kind of West Africa, and then they can go up to North Africa and then hop over the Bay of Biscay to England that way. So there is a sort of slightly more, it's a longer route, but it's the weather is sort of slightly kinder to them, to be perfectly honest. But the interesting thing is, by the time that Acre writes his case for daylight bombing, which is on the kind of eve of the Casablanca Conference in January 1943, which is the conference between the British and the American chiefs of staff, and Roosevelt and Churchill both attend, you know, they've only flown 39 missions or something. No, 29 missions. 29 missions that the 8th Bomber Command has flown by that point. So it's really, really piffling. And one of the main reasons is because a lot of the bomb groups that have been brought over for the 8th Air Force have then been siphoned off to North Africa, not least the 97th Bomb Group, which operates the first mission over to Rouen. And of course, you know, it's not really surprising because you think of the very small bar with which the United States Army Air Corps begins in September 1939, just 17,000 strong in the entire Air Corps. You know, you can't just click your fingers and those 50,000 aircraft just appear overnight. It takes time. So actually, the fact that they're operating as an air force at all
More importantly, their crews. I mean, because the American model of training is intensive and it's lengthy, isn't it? These guys are training for months, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
And while they have to be selected and weeded because they're looking for certain kinds of pilots for bombers and all this sort of thing. So it's a deep and complex training program. So you can't magic up the hundreds of thousands of people you need to fly these tens of thousands of bombers. It's just, or whatever it is you're aiming at, it can't just be done overnight. So I think what's striking is that when Acre writes that, this tiny air force, it's flown 29
missions. It's a projection of the future, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
not just a projection of the future. It's him. They're still lobbying. They're still arguing. They're still reassuring the government. They're reassuring FDR that he's signed the right checks, that this is going to work. This is the right way to do things. And that our way is the right way. Because after all, the year before, you've had the Butt report, which is basically, arguably, could have holed Bomber Command's campaign beneath the waterline. But after all, bombing is tied up in the idea that it's appearing to do something. It's a second front. It's your only option while you're not actually engaging the Germans on land and all that sort of stuff. And Acre's definitely considering that, isn't it? It's a way for America to engage the Germans, you know, take the war to Germany. Because how else do you do that with a gigantic army that has to burrow its way through Europe, you know? And no one quite wants to commit to that yet. To extend that point, I think it's just interesting that this is also the same point where you have Americans lobbying for an Overlord-style operation that year as well, which they obviously couldn't. These are statements of ambition, aren't they?
Yes.
And statements of intent.
Absolutely. Well, you know, because you can always roll back from something, but you can't, you know, if you don't have these lofty aims in the first place, it's very hard to sort of keep your focus. So I think that's entirely justified and completely understandable. But I think it's interesting. So Spots is the first commander of the Eighth, but he then comes over to command strategic air forces in the Mediterranean following Torch. So he's off, and Acre is the obvious person to take over from him as commander-in-chief of the 8th Air Force, and does so in December 1943. But one of the reasons why they fit, you know, it's interesting when you look at German bombers like the Heinkel 111 and the Dornier 17 and stuff, and you look at these, which are mid-1930s bombers, and they're looking tired and kind of out of date by the start of the war. The interesting thing about the B-17 is it absolutely isn't, and the consolidated B-24 with its tricycle undercarriage rather than being a tail dragger is even more so a sort of leap into the future. And part of the point is that, you know, they've got four engines, not two. So they're more robust. They're tougher. The airframes are tougher. So they can take that. It is understood that they can take punishment as well as giving punishment with their 13 machine guns. And this is why it's worth just mentioning a rabbit hole here, which actually takes us out of the Eighth, but because this involves a B-17 of the 97 bomb group, which is one of the pioneers, one of the originals of the Eighth Air Force, which comes over and flies on that mission to Rouen on the 17th of August 1942. But by the start of 1943, when Acre is writing his case for daylight bombing, is in the Mediterranean, is operating out of Algeria, and on the 1st of February 1943, there is one particular B-17 called the All American, which is part of the 414th Bomb Squadron, part of the 97th Bomb Group. And the bombardier is a chap called Lieutenant Ralph Burbridge, who some years ago I spoke to at some great length about this particular mission on the 1st of February 1943. He was from Missouri. He joined the USAAF just before Pearl Harbor, arrives in the UK in 1942. He's one of those who takes part in that first ever mission to Rouen on the 17th of August. And he's got 16 missions under his belt by the time he's posted to Algeria. So, you know, he's well on the way to achieving that magical 25 that they have to do before they can go home. But anyway, they take off from Biskra in Algeria at 10:50 a.m. on the 1st of February to attack Bizerta, which at that point is in German hands, which is just in the port north of Tunis in Tunisia. And at 1:40 p.m., they reach the Lac de Bizerta, and they hit the port okay, and then they're attacked by 109s. And suddenly there's a 109 is attacking from 12 o'clock high straight for them. Major Coulter, who's the squadron commander, his ship is hit, and they plunges to the ground, and that's that. And the second 109 then makes for the All-American. And the pilot, Lieutenant Ken Briggs, takes evasive action. And the 109 passes, and they all have a massive shoot. You know, all the machine guns are hammering away at it. And then they feel this slight jolt in the plane. Nothing more than that, just a slight jolt. And the top turret calls out, "Sir, we've received some damage in the tail section. I think you should have a look." And the fort is still flying okay, but the trim's not working. So Briggs hands over to Engel, who's the co-pilot, and goes back. And he cannot believe what he sees, because the fuselage has been 3/4 of the way sliced off. Part of the ME-109's wing is still embedded.
You see, the thing is, and we will post these pictures. There are photographs of this, which are absolutely incredible. The one on the ground, I can understand. I
cannot believe it.
Well, the one on the ground, I can understand. I mean, I can't believe it, but I can understand it. The one of them in the air, someone on another fortress had a camera, or someone.
Yeah, well, I guess so.
Or whenever it was coming home, they sent a lightning up or something to have a look. You know what I mean? But you've got to get a picture of this.
But anyway, the amazing thing is they make it back.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And they land. And even when it lands, it doesn't come to pieces.
Yeah.
And it makes the headlines in the Stars and Stripes. The unkindest cut of all, but bomber beats the rap. You know, I mean, it's just amazing. But in a way, this just reinforces the bomber men's view that, you know, that these fortresses, they've got this great machine that can take the hit. But anyway, back to Acres' case for daylight bombing, because it's January 1943. It is the Casablanca Conference, and he's one of the men who is invited to come and attend this and do his bit. You know, Tui Spats is there to fight the US corner, but so is Acre. And unlike most US senior commanders, Acre had come really, really prepared. because famously, the American chiefs of staff are caught short by the British, who've absolutely ambushed them in terms of the strategic plans and don't have an answer for it. But Acre is not one of those. You know, he's clever, because he's smart. He's actually, I forgot to mention in the last episode, he's also done a course in journalism. So, right. You know, he can write. Exactly. He knows how to present a case. So he does this case for day bombing. And he points out, look, if we do this, and the RAF continue to bomb by night, then we can do round-the-clock bombing and give the Germans no rest. And that means that, you know, they can't have flat gunners working 24 hours a day. Or they can, but that means they're going to have to halve their number. So, you know, that's an advantage. It prevents putting excess strain on the British airspace and comms, inarguable. It would be more accurate because it's daylight, and the British are all sort of, you know, scratching their chins, and they're rubbing their chins sort of sagely at this point, because they know that, well, maybe over El Paso, old chum, but try doing that over Schweinfurt. Yes. And he also points out the daylight bombing, and this is almost, I would say, the key argument of all, would force the Luftwaffe back to the Reich, where enemy day fighter force would be compelled to take to the sky to defend the airspace. Because this is a problem that the RAF have had up until this point, is they go over and do these fighter sweeps over Western France. And you know, the Luftwaffe don't play ball, or very rarely play ball. And when they're bombing at night, you know, fighters don't come into it. But what you're trying to do, ultimately, for the Operation Overlord, as it will become, the cross-channel invasion, is you need to clear that airspace. We'll go on to that later.
But Jim, when you summarize it like that, who does it sound like it's tailored to convince? Winston Churchill is the answer.
Yes, and it does convince him.
And it does him. It does. And this shows, you know, Acre quite clearly has assessed, you know, the target and has done some precision bombing on it. Churchill, anything where you can go to Winston Churchill and say, give the Hun no rest, absolutely marvellous stuff. It's as if
Europe ablaze.
Exactly.
Nazis.
It'll put less strain on British airspace, sir. And there's also that idea of it being more accurate, because at this time, it's only at the very end of the war where Churchill suddenly sort of starts to blanch about the strategic bombing campaign, isn't it? But the idea that it's more accurate has got to appeal on some level. But this, and also the idea that you destroy the Luftwaffe, force the Luftwaffe to battle and all this sort of stuff. You can see that Acre has really thought carefully about the fact he's got to get this by Churchill.
And the language he's using.
Exactly, the language he's using. And because Acre, in his time in Britain in 42, has experienced quite a lot of pressure from the British to join the night bombing campaign. I mean, quite a lot of pressure, hasn't he? He's been told, you should just throw your lot in with us. And the British are saying, daylight's too dangerous. The trade-off of the risks against the accuracy, it's just not there. Accuracy is impossible anyway, as the Butt report proves.
But also, you know that Harris, who is the commander-in-chief of the former command, and has been in post since February 1942, and has spent the first year of his command kind of sort of building up strength and building up navigational aids before his planned all-out assault of strategic air campaign against Germany, which he's planning to begin at the beginning of March 1943. You know, he's thinking, fine, whatever. Try it, and then you'll come back to our way of thinking.
Yeah. That's very much his attitude, yeah.
He's very censorious, and he just sits there just thinking,
dream on.
I'm not going to argue with you. You crack on. You do whatever you want, but you'll come back to my way of thinking in very quick order.
Acre sits Churchill down personally, doesn't he? And takes him through this, doesn't he? So it's not just a staff conference presentation. He goes and sees Churchill personally. He sits him down and pitches it to him. Combined bomber offensive
And compelling German day fighters to attack. That's into the air. That's the thing. Although at this stage, it has to be said that although fighter groups are part of the eighth, it is absolutely still considered that these mass formations on their own
it's
a bomber force will be defended enough just by virtue of their 1350 caliber machine guns per bomber, and it's all going to be fine. And so there's a sort of, you know, a potential misappreciation of that. So subsequent to the Casablanca conference, a directive is issued demanding the progressive destruction and dislocation of the German military, industrial, and economic system, and the undermining of the morale of the German people to a point where their capacity for armed resistance is fatally weakened. Now, we've said this one, but that we've come up this line before, I think, when we were doing Gomorrah. But the interesting thing is that is applied to both the United States Army Air Force and the RAF, so Bomber Command and the 8th Air Force, are given carte blanche for all-out strategic bombing, but on their own terms. It's very vague. It's very vague. So do it your own way.
Do it your own way. Because after all, undermining a morale, it becomes an enormous point of argument, had been a point of argument before the war among the people in America arguing about bombing. And because if you're just doing it to undermine people's morale, how do you even measure that? You know, whereas you can take a photograph of a smashed up factory. You can take a photograph of a smashed up oil refinery. You can't take a photograph of undermined morale. There's no way of putting it in a blue book like Harris has, these enormous binders with basically everywhere in Germany assessed as a military target, its potential as a military target weighed up. It's impossible to assess, but it's in the mix there because the whole point of this directive is that it's vague. Progressive destruction, so not immediate. Dislocation, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Military, industrial, economics. Any economic system could mean literally anything, because you could argue that the roundabout at the end of the end of the road on from mine is part of the economic system because lorries have to drive through it. And it basically means you go away and you try, but that's what strategic bombing is from now on. Bomber Command doing its thing, the US Army Air Force doing its thing. There isn't, we will attack oil, you will attack ball bearings, you do cities, we do whatever. Those arguments are removed from this. So in a strange way, it's a brilliant directive because it tells everyone what to do without telling them what to do.
I think the other thing that's really interesting about this is because Acre has spoken to Churchill and because he has got, you know, the Americans have got the green light for continuing daylight, inverted commas, precision bombing. This gives Acre, who is now Commander-in-Chief of the 8th Air Force, back at Pine Tree at High Wycombe, Wycombe Abbey rather, you know, he can now develop this idea and develop his force. So the first 6 months of 1943 for the 8th Air Force are very much a half year of development. This is growth. This is building up in much the same way that Harris has been building up his own force of Bomber Command in 1942. And it's interesting that, you know, the 8th Air Force begins life with 7 men and absolutely no aircraft whatsoever in February 1942. But by June 1943, it's got 4 wings, 18th bomb groups, 4 fighter groups, 6 bomb groups had arrived in the spring. But of course, you know, all this takes time. You know, it is growing. And certainly by June, it's capable of putting out kind of, you know, 200, 250 bombers. But that's still nothing like enough. But it is a force that is on the rise.
Well, because again, you fall into this problem they have pre-war, which you've got this idea, but there's an experience vacuum. So you've got to get these crews experienced. You've got to try some of this stuff out. But a big part of your bomber philosophy is that you do it by overwhelming the enemy with a giant bomber formation. You haven't got a giant bomber formation.
Yeah. So let's go to the marshalling yards in Rouen. Let's go to France.
Exactly.
Let's do milk runs in Holland or whatever, and just sort of test the water a little bit. And that's fine. So. You know, 8th Air Force is doing operations in the first half of 1943, but, you know, one has to kind of make it absolutely clear that these are pretty small scale in the big scheme of things. You know, there are occasional ones into the Ruhr or up to sort of Bremen and Wilhelmshaven and all this kind of stuff. But for the most part, these are what would later be called a milk run. But at the same time, Acre is also thinking really hard about how this all looks once he's got his force at a kind of certain strength. You know, what will they be able to achieve? What will they do? And what he comes up with, which is a development of his case for daylight bombing, encouraged by his conversations with Churchill and others at the Casablanca conference, which is the Combined Pommer Offensive, the CBO. And this is approved by the British Air Staff, but because it's his and it's so obviously his, it becomes known as the Acre Plan. And this acknowledges that Luftwaffe fighter strength is growing, and thus the success of bombing Germany is dependent on destroying German fighter strength. And Acre refers to the immediate objective as destroying German fighter strength. And what he means by immediate is intermediate, rather, is immediate.
Yeah. He says that the German fighter force is taking a toll of our forces both by day and by night, not only in terms of combat losses, but more especially in terms of reduced tactical effectiveness. If the German fighters are materially increased in number, it is quite conceivable that they could make our daylight bombing unprofitable, and perhaps our night bombing too. So he's saying we need to do something about fighter strength right now, because which is really, really interesting, isn't it? Because this is that's a mile off from the bomber will always get through. Our bombers have sufficient defensive firepower to do anything they possibly need to.
Yes, and it's not that Acre's not looking at what is happening in North Africa. And, you know, what happens to the All American is it's attacked by Messerschmitts. One of them shot down. One of them makes it home, but with three quarters of its fuselage sliced in half.
Yeah.
So you know, you can take a number of lessons from that. You can say, well, you know, it's great that the B-17 is so robust, but you can also say, fighter planes, they are getting through here. literally, you know, and Acre is not an idiot, so he's sort of starting to get that.
But he's playing the cards he's been dealt by previous policy and procurement, isn't he? I mean, he can't magic up a fighter wing to solve the problem, and he hasn't got a long range fighter either, because critically, that's an idea that people have simply said is impossible,
or just not thought about. They just haven't applied themselves in the same way they have to a kind of bomb site or something.
Well, it's interesting because they do drop tank experiments in the 1920s, and basically go, yeah, they work. Oh, well, we're not going to need them.
Whatever.
We're not going to need them because the fighter isn't a threat to our bomber force anyway. So the ideas are there, but they haven't been seized upon.
But what you see in this crucial 6 months, and you have to see in the 8th Air Force, what you're talking about is the evolution of American strategic bombing of Germany. So the evolution of that strategy is developed by Acre in this first 6 months of 1942. So it's a really, really formative moment in the history of American air power, but more specifically, the history of the United States 8th Air Force. And what he's starting to realize is that actually that intermediate target, that immediate target, the first priority is the German aircraft industry and indeed the Luftwaffe. So what he starts to envisage is the gradual destruction of the Luftwaffe in terms of targeting airframe, aero engine component, ball bearing plants, and hammering these repeatedly, whilst at the same time drawing enemy fighters into the air.
Yeah.
That's the strategy. So he says, you know, it is emphasized that the reduction of the German fighter force is essential to our progression to the attack of other sources of the enemy war potential, and any delay in its prosecution will make the task progressively more difficult. So what he's saying is we need to knock the Luftwaffe on the head now, then without the Luftwaffe, which is our most dangerous, you know, the German fighters as a day bomber, that is our most dangerous enemy rather than flak. Rather than an anti-aircraft gun, and he's absolutely correct, because a fighter pass has a kind of 1 in 5 chance of hitting, whereas an anti-aircraft shell has a 0.002% chance of hitting. So he's absolutely bang on that.
But does he have the means? It's the simple question, Nick.
Well, what you're no, absolutely, and this is the point, because what you're seeing is now we're actually in the war. We can start to practically test the theories of the 1930s, and while our ultimate tenet, i.e. bombing is what it's all about, is true. What is clearly where we've undercooked is on the fighter escort bit. And how do we overcome that?
Well, how we will ever be able to bomb the way we intend to bomb, you know, that we've got to get over that fence, perhaps.
And also, we've got to do some testing here, because we've got to see whether these mass formations of bombers, once you've got a formation of 300 bombers in tight boxes, in tight closed convoy formation. Will that be enough to kind of get through to these targets where the, I mean, because that's the interesting thing is that very conveniently, the Ruhr industrial heartland is in the west of Germany, which makes it geographically, you know, very straightforward for bombers flying out of East Anglia or Lincolnshire to attack it.
Fly across Holland, you're there, basically.
Yeah, and you're there. It's really straightforward. The problem with the aircraft industry is most of it is deep into the Reich, and a lot of it is in the southern part of the Reich, you know, around sort of Munich.
Bavaria and engineering.
Bavaria, yeah, and even into Austria, you know, sort of Wiener Neustadt and all the rest of it.
Bomber Command, Harris is basically going, yeah, that sounds great in principle, but don't worry, we're going to carry on doing our thing, because he's basically resorting to the... He's resorting to the Casablanca directive, isn't he? Where he's going, yeah, you know, we're by any means possible, each to his own. Thanks very much. I mean, I'm sure you're right, but good luck again. Because Harris's attitude is just, I got to make this thing work. I got to protect my crews. I'm not interested in bright ideas, basically.
And he also just doesn't believe that bomber formations, even if they've got, you know, mass numbers of 50 caliber machine guns, he just doesn't think they're going to be able to protect themselves. So he thinks the whole plan is entirely flawed. He is literally just sitting back waiting for the 8th Air Force to sort of tow his way of thinking. But having said that, you know, Aker comes up with this plan, which is, you know, this is the strategy that we should have. It should absolutely focus on destroying the Luftwaffe and the German aircraft industry as a primary target until we can, and when we've done that, then we can think of other targets. And this is handed over to Harris to tweak, and he goes, yeah, absolutely fine, whatever, as long as I can retain control over what targets I choose. And so he goes, fine, you crack on. So this is signed off by the combined chiefs of staff.
It's worth noting, isn't it? Aker gets along with everyone. It's very charming, isn't he? So there's a big...
No, Harris likes him, and
Harris likes him. They really get on, don't they? And they weekend together and stuff. And he gets on. He can handle Portal really well, and he's great. I think what's really interesting is often when people talk about you know, Allied strategy, they look for butting heads, don't they? But this is a situation where actually these people are disagreeing, but they're getting along terribly well. Actually, Aker is incredibly good at charming everyone and being friendly and all that, isn't it? So that there are disagreements here, and they're big disagreements, and they're important disagreements, but that no one's falling out with anyone, are they? Harris is like, well, you do your thing, chum. And it's not the sort of more acerbic Harris who people maybe think of. He's signing his memo going, no, that ain't happening for us. You know, good luck. I mean, when Aker arrives in the UK, Harris is very keen on encouraging him to night bomb and pick his brains and all this sort of stuff. And there is a frank exchange of information. So this isn't a thing that's happening into sort of completely separate bubbles, is it? Which I think is really, really interesting. It's not an allies at war thing, this.
Oh, absolutely not at all. You know, Harris is just saying, you know, good luck with it, but you know, we've got our way, and this works for us. You know, you crack on and absolutely get the benefits of round-the-clock bombing. I get all that, and I understand the benefits of doing this. You know, I mean, I wish you all the best. I just don't think it's going to work. But, you know, happy to be proved wrong. But the result of this,
yeah,
is Operation Point Blank.
Yeah.
And Operation Point Blank is a combined bomber offensive operation. So it is, you know, Bomber Command is signing up to it, but it is going to be led by the 8th Air Force and subsequently the 15th Air Force in Italy in future months. And that is agreed and signed off on the 10th of June, 1943. And this is the moment where suddenly 8th Air Force has a raison d'etre. That it's built up some strength. It's got a mission. And the mission is the destruction of the Luftwaffe and the German Air Force. This is what it's all about. And there is another incentive for this and for the signing off of Point Blank, because it has been agreed in the month before, in May 1943, at the Trident Conference between the British and the Americans in Washington, that Operation Overlord is going to be the priority objective. Yeah. And Operation Overlord, as we all know, is a cross-channel invasion, which at this point in 1943 is scheduled for the 1st of May 1944.
Yeah.
And for that to happen, an absolutely non-negotiable prerequisite is clearing of the airspace of Northwest Europe. And the reason you need to do this is because, and it's worth just saying this very quickly before we come to the break, is because the moment you land in Normandy, the cat is out of the bag, and then it's a race for who can build up men and material quickest into the bridgehead. Will it be the Allies who've got to get across the channel in shipping, or will it be the Germans who've already got a foot on the, you know, already on the continent? So the way you slow that down is by hampering the Germans' ability to get to Normandy. And you do that by destroying bridges, marshalling yards, railway lines, their lines of communication. And you can only do that by very, very accurate low-level bombing in sort of medium bombers, twin-engine bombers. And you can only do that if you've got command of the airspace. You can't do that if you've got Messerschmitt 109s and Fokker Wulf 190s hovering over you. So you absolutely have to clear the airspace before you can do the invasion.
So the matter of German fighters, which Aker has been stressing, and fighter trying to do something about German fighter dominance, is now not just central to his bombing strategy, but actually central to the entire direction of Allied strategy for the following year.
Against Nazi Germany, correct.
Exactly.
Everything is on them. And this is why what they're doing and why point blank is so absolutely key. It is almost the key strategy in 1943 for the Allies for the rest of the war. I mean, you know, up until D-Day, certainly. You know, so a huge amount is resting on the shoulders of this still very fledgling air force as it is in the summer of 1943.
So we will take a break and then we'll come back and see, well, who they are, what they are, and how that task might pan out in 1943.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Wondersuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Learn more at Bluehost.com/Wondersuite.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk and our US My 8th Air Force, the Mighty 8th series that we're doing for you. And in the first half, we've talked strategy, we've talked the exigencies of developing Allied strategy, Ira Aker's ability to handle Churchill, or was it Churchill's ability to handle Ira Aker, of course?
Wow, yes. Which one first?
Because his advisors saw him coming as well. Churchill's advisors saw Aker coming. So there's a you know, swings and roundabouts.
But I thought in the second half we'd focus on one of the experiences of one of the bomb groups. And this, of course, is the 100th bomb group, which is, it has to be said, the focus of Masters of the Air. John Orloff's brilliant script based on the Donald Miller book of the same title, which is a brilliant book, it has to be said. It's a great book. Everyone should read it. It's terrific.
Although that's about the entire Air Force rather than 100th Bomber Group. So
yes, but the 100th BG is very much his focus, isn't it? It's like his daddy.
It's his
group,
touchstone. It's the one he keeps coming back to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, they're based in Thorpe Abbotts, but they come from Keeney in Nebraska.
Yep. Arrive on the 9th of June, 1943. So they arrived the day before Point Blank is signed off.
Right. So they couldn't be any more sort of tied to it and its fortunes and on message.
Yeah,
and all that. And they're transposed essentially en masse, aren't they, after 7 months of setting up and training, sort of plonked in England.
It is amazing, you know, whether it be the 82nd Airborne or 101st or these infantry divisions or whatever, which are sort of, you know, created. These formations are created whole. You know, so they recruit the staff, they recruit the men, then they start training guys in and they're allocated and you build up and you've got 7 months of all operating together, training together. You've got your aircraft, then you're good to go. And you all fly over en masse and here you are. Suddenly you've got kind of, you know, 40 aircraft and 40 crews.
And it's in Norfolk, isn't it? Just up the road from Diss.
Yes, it's right on the Norfolk-Suffolk border. It's literally, you know, half a mile and you're in Suffolk. Yeah, it's lovely. It's a beautiful little village. It's got a sort of gorgeous little sort of flint church, and it's a sort of sleepy little place. And the airfield is north of the village. There's some woods, and a lot of the sort of Quonset huts where the men were kind of housed were in those woods. And you can see the remains of them, sort of brick walls and little, you know, the outline of where they all were in these woods. And then north of the woods is this huge kind of sort of, you know, where the airfield once was. You can still see the hard standing. And on the far side, on the north, is where the control tower is. And you know, it's like so many of these places in Norfolk, these airfields, which were sort of springing up all over the place. You know, it's home to suddenly 3,000 young Americans on the top of a village, which is home to kind of, you know, 400 people.
Yeah, and obviously has a radical effect on the neighbourhood.
Yeah, yeah. It's got two T2 hangars, which are the sort of standard, you know, the classic hangar. 52 hard standings built, massive offices, office buildings, maintenance sheds, and it's given the number Station 139, built by the British, incidentally.
Yeah, but there's an engineering company, or a hardcore company, or someone providing concrete who's making a tiny packet.
It's all McAlpine and Wimpey. It's all those names that are still there to this day.
Incredible.
They're the people doing it all. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so 100th Bomber Group, they're part of the 13th Combat Wing alongside 309th Bomber Group and 95th Bomber Group. Are you keeping track, everyone? So, what I do love about the Americans, it's all big numbers. It's all 100ths, 390ths, 95ths. You know, you're immediately into three figure numbers for formations. Like, there's no not going to muck about with a first and second. You know, like we're straight up to the 100th. So they've arrived in on the 9th of June, and they fly their first combat mission basically 2 weeks later.
So the original numbers that come over, I think it's 36 crews or 40 crews that come over, and these are known as the originals coming over on the 9th of June 1943. And it's part of the 13th Combat Wing alongside the 390th and the 95th Bomb Group. So these guys are very often kind of sort of operating together. And which of these bomb groups ends up at the bottom and the back is rather depends on, you know, the results of who gets off best and worst on any particular mission. But anyway, they flew their first mission on the 25th of June 1943, just three losses in the 349th Bomb Squadron. And it's worth just mentioning two of the originals, who are Major Gale Buck Cleaven and Major John Egan. And Egan had reached England back in March 1943 and then joins the 100th on its arrival as the operations officer and then becomes the commanding officer of the 418th Bomb Squadron. Egan, short, skinny, 27 years old, so still pretty damn young. Yeah.
You say young, I say old. I mean, for these people, he's an old timer, isn't he?
Yeah.
Young enough for me. I mean, I just think how, when I was 27, how utterly unsuited I'd have been to any of this.
Oh, my God. But yeah.
But compared to them, he's ancient, isn't he, essentially? And then Cleveland's 24 years old and given command of the 350 Bomber Squadron in July 42. I mean, I just think, again, we do talk about this a fair bit. Or we have over the years, how young these people are and the responsibility they have and how obviously the Air Force can recognize who's going to, who it wants to give the responsibility to, and then people rise to it. I think it's just absolutely, just that responsibility alone before you fly into combat, just extraordinary. All those people looking to you for decision and example and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. So much resting on your shoulders. I remember talking to Billy Drake, the legendary fighter pilot in the RAF, who commanded, you know, he was shot down over France in a hurricane in 1940, later commanded the 112 Shark Squadron, Kitty Hawks in North Africa. And he said, you have no idea how much responsibility you have as a kind of sort of 23-year-old as a squadron commander. He said, you know, it's extraordinary. You know, you were just left to run the show as you wanted. And he said, you know, if I didn't think someone was up to it, I'd just fire them. I'd just get rid of the pilot. You know. He said, you know, he said, that may sound really tough, but he said, yeah, it's a deadly business. You've got to be tough.
You're sparing them in one way, aren't you?
Of course. But that kind of sort of that thought really kind of applies to bomb groups and bomb squadrons as well. Anyway, the thing about Cleveland and Egan is that they've been mates since joining the Air Corps together at Randolph Field in Texas back in 1940. So they're really, really tight, best of mates. And they're now in the same bomb group together. They're both living at Fort Abbott's. You know, they're super tight. And there is this sense, I think, with the 100th Bomb Group, these originals, that they are a band of brothers. You know, that these are guys who've been created together in Keeney in Nebraska. They've lived and drunk and laughed and hurled and cried and all that kind of stuff together. And here they all are on this big adventure.
But they're going first, so that's the thing that really...
And they're the pioneers. You know, they're testing it. They're testing the theories from the 1930s, the evolving theories of men like Ira Aker, commander-in-chief of 8th Air Force. And they're the guinea pigs in many ways. But they're excited by this. You know, they're cherishing the bombing missions. You know, that's still very much the forefront in that Aker was saying in January 1943. They're still thinking that in June 1943, you know, 6 months further on. You know, these guys are pumped. They're up for it. They think they're going to be the heroes that are going to change the way warfare's fought. And yes, it's not without its dangers, but it's an awfully big adventure. No one's sitting there thinking they're all going to get shot down in droves. That is just not on their radar at all.
No, not yet, anyway. I mean,
I'm talking about June 1943.
Yeah, I know. And they're flying this sci-fi superplane that can drop a bomb in a pickle barrel, that flies high and fast, relatively speaking. They're all incredibly well trained. I mean, they've all got hours and hours and hours, hundreds of hours on the thing, and they all know what they're doing.
But
I mean,
in fine weather in North Africa.
Yes, of course.
No, North America, rather.
Yes, of course. Oh, it's very interesting because in Don Miller's Mighty Eighth book, he says, you know, when faced with the most unusual weather system in the world, and you sort of think, well, you say that. Maybe your weather system over America is unusual.
Try going to kind of the Amazon.
Well, Japan, you know, because they run into all those stratospheric problems in Japan with the B-29 that they don't anticipate later in the war. You know, like, who are you calling unusual, mate, is the thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, try going to the Barents Sea.
Exactly. Our weather's normal.
Try going to Bear Island, for goodness sake.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But so Cleveland's first mission is to Bremen.
That's not an easy one, to be fair.
That's not easy.
And that's the 25th of June, 1943. But by the 17th of August, he's got 10 in the bag, and the 11th is the Schweinfurt Regensburg raid of the 17th of August 1943.
Now, Regensburg is where they make Messerschmitt 109s, right?
It is.
So why wouldn't you attack it? Aker's determination to attack fighter production, when you put it like that, why wouldn't you do it?
Well, this is Operation Point Blank, isn't it? You know, it's
exactly. You're getting on with what you've got to get on with. And the 100th, they're targeting Regensburg. They're positioned in what's called the coffin corner, so the last and lowest group in the bomber formation. So essentially, you're the stragglers, aren't you, effectively?
Yeah. And they're already, by this stage, they're starting to sort of, you know, this is... So the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid is the first big, deep penetration of the Reich that they've done. But even so, you know, they've been taking hits, and no one is anticipating this to be particularly easy, but they have massed 315 aircraft bombers for this particular operation, which is the largest to date. And, you know, that's a big deal.
It's a long way. And at the briefings, people say things like, what idiot at 8th Air Force headquarters dreamed this one up? So there's a fair deal of, by now they have an understanding of what the Luftwaffe are capable of. And of course the Luftwaffe are adapting and have come up with Galland. Adolf Galland has come up with this head-on technique, hasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And, which has been developed this summer. This is the summer of 1943 when it happens.
The Fortress only has one forward-facing machine gun, doesn't it? It's not the bomb aimer, is it? Is it the flight engineer?
It's Bombardier.
So the Bombardier takes it on when he's not being a Bombardier. And it's only a 30 cal, isn't it? So there's clearly a question about how well defended the Fortress is from the front. And I remember Mackie Steinhoff's book where he talks about Galland coming down to see them in Sicily and saying, right, this is what you do with the fortresses. You fly straight at them. And Steinhoff's going, Jesus Christ, I mean, who is he to tell us this? But actually, Galland's right. That is they call them Boeings.
Well, it is that stage. They soon get rid of the 30 cals and put 50 cals in. But
that's right. They call them Boeings, don't they? The Germans. And that's the way you deal with a Boeing. As we said in the last episode, you fly straight at it. So the 100th fly, the Regensburg raid, and the casualties on that are appalling, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, and it's worth just sort of talking through Cleveland's mission. So, you know, their ship is being absolutely shredded by bullets and flak and, you know, peppering it, the whole thing. And they're actually justified in bailing out, and his co-pilot, Captain Richard Carey, was all set to do so. But by this time, the B-17 that Cleveland is piloting is suffering structural damage, partial loss of control, there's fire in the air and serious injuries to some of the crew, and fresh waves of fighters are attacking them. But over the intercom, Cleveland calmly insists that they press on. And Cleveland gets a Distinguished Service Cross for this. And the story gets written up in the Saturday Evening Post by Lieutenant Colonel Bernard Lay Jr., who's a guy who later writes 12 o'clock high. And it very much sort of puts 100th Bomb Group on the fore. But they do Cleveland does get back. And the casualties are absolutely enormous because they lose 60 aircraft on the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid. You know, out of 315, it's a huge, huge amount.
Yeah, I mean, if people want to read about that raid in particular, or those raids in particular, Martin Middlebrook wrote an excellent book about them.
Yes, he did. But people are starting to realise that numbers are diminishing very fast. They were already diminishing before the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid, but the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid really brings it to focus that actually they're not just losing a few, they're getting slaughtered. And infamously, there's one replacement crewman that arrives at Fort Abbas in time for a late meal, goes to bed, but gets lost over Germany the next morning. And no one ever knew his name because he'd only just arrived. So he became the man who came to dinner. And you know, it's that kind of sort of gallows humour which is starting to take root. You know you've got a problem, actually.
Yeah. Well, Cleveland and Egan become figures, heroes within the 100th.
Yeah, they're like school hero. They're like the captain of the football team.
Yeah, but Cleveland really doesn't like the idea of this. I mean, that's more responsibility, isn't it? He doesn't want to be seen as dashing or heroic.
Yeah, and so these new crews would arrive and they'd sort of go, oh, you're Egan and Cleveland, because, you know, I read you up in the Saturday Evening Post and they know all about them. So they're kind of like sort of famous figures. And Cleveland says, you know, their fear wasn't as great as ours and therefore was more dangerous. They feared the unknown. We feared the known. And there is this mounting sense that things are getting worse. And basically throughout the rest of August and September, Acre doesn't attempt any point-blank targets at all, or barely any, no, certainly nothing in the right, because they've been decimated by the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid, and they've got to build up strength all over again. And they've also got a sort of, you know, this horrible feeling that actually, what if all their, you know, all their pre-war planning and assumptions has been wrong, and all that assumptions from the combined bomber offensive and from the Acre plan and all the rest of it that he was outlining initially in the case for daylight bombing back in January 1943. What if that's all been mistaken? It's a horrible feeling. On the 8th of October, Buck Cleveland takes off for an attack on Bremen and doesn't return. You know, gets shot down, ends up being the, you know, three 109s, tore out the sun, knock out three engines, shredding the four and starting a fire in the cockpit. And Cleveland orders them to jump. He's the last man out, jumping only at 2,000 feet. And, you know, they spend the rest of the war as a prisoner of war. The next mission is Munster, and this is the day of infamy for the 100th Bomb Group. It's Sunday, the 10th of October. It's the 100th Bomb Group's mission number 35, pre-bright briefing. The target today, gentlemen, is Munster. And there's the red string across the map over the North Sea, over the Netherlands to a town just over the other side of the Dutch border. And actually, it's only just in the Ruhr, and it's not expected to be a particularly tough fight, not least because P-47s can escort them pretty much all the way. The aim is to hit the main railway station, the main railway workers' residential areas. So a lot of the area, the railway workers that operate in the Ruhr area are based in residential terraces in Munster. So the idea is to kill the men. Is to kill the civilians, you know. So you can have your kind of we want precision bombing and we're going to be more ethical and all the rest of it. But this is out and out getting the workers.
This is the thing that people agonised over for two decades in the interwar years, and tried to forswear themselves from doing. And here they are essentially doing it, which is interesting because the crews have all been raised on this milk that they're doing precision bombing and they're going to win the war clean, aren't they? And in a way, this is the beginning, isn't it? The beginning of that. And after all, they've not been bombing. A lot of the bombing they've done has killed enough civilians anyway, but they've tried not to. This is, they're really not trying not to here in this instance.
No, and there's discomfort about this amongst the bomb crews, amongst the crews as well. They're not like quite sure about that. But Egan is flying that day, and he's flying with Captain John Brady in Mademoiselle Zigzag, and they take off as the lead ship at 11 minutes past 11 a.m. on that Sunday, the 10th of October, 1943. Part of this concentrated, massed effort to hit point-blank targets, first time since the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid in August, and now it's October 1943. So 53 bombers of the 13th Combat Wing are assembled over Great Yarmouth, and the 100th is forming the bottom and back. Coffin Corner, behind the leading 95th Bomb Group. Over the North Sea, four bombers turn back.
Let's say you're turning back, right?
Yeah.
You've got an engine problem. What if you turn back, you land back, and there's nothing, it transpires, there's nothing wrong with your aircraft? Is there an LMF thing in the, although we've talked about that, a lack of moral fibre thing?
Yeah, you do get in pretty big trouble, I think.
You get in pretty big trouble. Okay.
Well, I don't mean it's called LMS.
So turning back isn't done lightly, is what I'm saying.
No.
You know, so far in these two podcasts, we've made very clearly the case for turning back.
No, but I suppose if you think the 100 Bomb Group is having this very intense period of combat operations, you've survived, you know, you've survived Bremen, but you've got some damage and it hasn't quite been fixed up, and you know, you suddenly realise the hydraulics aren't working, or you know, something. Obviously, you don't want to be going over if you've got a slightly dud aircraft. So you know, I think that's entirely understandable. But of course, you know, one has to remember that by October, in a way that hasn't been. Gomorrah, the destruction from Hamburg, is at the very end of July, beginning of August 1943. By the time of the Schweinfurt Regensburg raid, you know, the air defense system hasn't been overhauled. By the beginning of October, it absolutely has been overhauled, and it's very much the same basis that the British air defense system is based, the Downing system, i.e. you have observers on the ground, you have radar chains, you have central hubs, you have you no longer have the Himmelblatt system, which is this idea that you have, you know, fighter planes and night fighters operating in blocks, and they only operate in their particular area, which is then overwhelmed by the bomber stream of Bomber Command. By this stage, you've got fighter aircraft all over the Reich. You've got plenty of early warning systems, a very sophisticated radar, very sophisticated control rooms with sort of, you know, glass walls with lights and all the rest of it. So the ground controllers down on the ground can absolutely control the battle, control where you can see where the bombers are coming. You've got listening services as well as observers on the ground. So you've got people tuning into American and indeed British radio chatter and picking up their signals and working out where they are. You've got the radar, you've got the observers, you know, altogether that gives you a very good intelligence picture of the intentions of the enemy forces coming over. And as I said in the last one, the point about being in a large formation is, yes, you might have security, but it makes it very darn obvious where you are, because you represent a very big blot on a radar screen. And if you're going in a sort of in a straight line towards Bremen, it's pretty obvious that that's where you're heading. So it doesn't take much to sort of second guess your movement, which then means from a German point of view, you're much more easy to intercept. And what happens on this particular raid of Munster, which should have been fairly okay, is that the Thunderbolts turn for home just on the edge of the Dutch-German border. And no sooner do they do so than the German fighters turn up again. So, you know, you might have not bothered having the fighter escort in the first place. And the bombers are just lining up on the IP, which is the initial point, the start of the bomb run, when out of the sun at 12 o'clock high again come 200 enemy fighters head on. And, you know, Brady's plane is hit first, falls out of formation. Egan is overseeing the abandoning of the plane when it bursts into flames. Egan and Brady put the fort onto automatic pilot and scramble back to open the bomb bay, and they all jump. Egan's shot at as he drifts down, but despite that, he's by being nicked, his parachute riddled, he managed to make it safely, and after shedding his chute heads into woods, but he's picked up and like his pal Cleveland, spends the rest of the war at a POW. And you know what the Germans are doing is they're not only deploying the Galland approach of attacking head on, they're also focusing on one combat wing at a time, so that rather than going for the whole formation, they hone in on one bit and smother that and take them, pick them off at a time. And it's an incredibly effective way. You know, in 7 minutes, the 100th Bomb Group ceases to exist because they're flying 13 ships that day and 12 of them are shot down. And only one makes it home from Munster. And that is damaged with two engines missing. So that's kind of, you know, that's effectively 100% gone. And what is amazing is that on the 14th, Black Thursday, so just 4 days later, the 100th Bomb Group is still expected to fly on Schweinfurt 2, because you never fly all your ships in one mission, a bit like you would have left out of battle with an infantry unit. But amazingly, on that day, all of them survive because they're not in the coffin corner. You know, they're in a different part of the, you know, the Germans haven't picked on them on that particular occasion, so they managed to get back. But you know, Since those 140 crews, those 40 crews have arrived on the 9th of June 1943 to October. So what's that? That's 4 months, isn't it? In 4 months, they've arrived of 140 officers. Only three remain. And since the beginning of October, it's lost two squadron commanders, four lead crews, and three operations officers.
You see, if I didn't know what was going to happen next, as it were, how on earth do you sustain this? How on earth do you justify sustaining this? Or what the hell do you do about it?
This is the moment of crisis, because the fact of the matter is, by this moment, middle of October 1943, less than one in four crew members could expect to complete 25 missions, such is the attrition rate. 2/3 of crews could expect to die or be captured. 17% would be wounded. Only 14% of a crewman that arrived with the 100th bomb group made it to 25 missions.
I don't like dem odds, is what I'm saying.
No, it's amazing. And the fact remains that 77% of the Americans who flew with the Mighty 8 from its start back in June 1942 to June 1944, D-Day, that's 2 years, would become casualties. So what that leaves you with is, by mid-October, Acres' plan is being shredded. 8th Air Force is in crisis. Point blank doesn't look like it's got a hope of ever being achieved, because you can't get into the Reich without fighter escorts. The fighter escorts they do have are ineffectual because they have to turn back too soon. And you've got a massive, massive problem on your hands, of which there is not, you know, there is no obvious immediate short-term solution. And the clock is ticking towards D-Day, which is still scheduled for the 1st of May 1944. And at that point, you have to have the skies over Northwest Europe completely clear of the Luftwaffe. And that is a million miles away in the middle of October 1943.
And that objective in itself is a million miles away from all the clever people with their good-intentioned thinking before the war. The intention of the bomber arm was to bring about a decision in a future war, but not by creating destroying the enemy air force, but by intervening strategically against the enemy, which the assumption was not by encountering an air force, but it may turn out that strategic bombing is actually the way you deliver a strategic outcome, but not by the way you originally envisaged, which I think is really, really, really fascinating.
Well, in the next episode, we're going to be turning our attention to the fighter force, which is the contrast between the fighter force and the bomber force. It just couldn't be more stark. And we'll be looking at that, and we'll be looking at the crisis and how the US 8th Air Force starts slowly but surely to overcome that crisis. And it's just so interesting.
And at the same time, also deal with its expansion that's coming, because there's a coming expansion. That this is the thing. Or that the whole of this period that we're talking about, there are replacement aircraft, there are replacement crews coming in, and there's tons of stuff, just this amazing permanent flow, which partly answers the question of how Acres is able to keep doing this over and over again. Anyway, we will be back with another installment.
Episode 3.
We haven't made a commitment to how many it will be in the end. If you want them all at once, though, rather than once as they dribble out, search for our channel on Apple Podcasts and subscribe with just those two easy clicks. It's ad-free, and we have curated playlists of our previous episodes. So our episodes sort of shepherded like wayward sheep into different pens, and you can then clip on your woolly favourite. Or, of course, you can join patreon.com/wehaveways, where you get that and a live cast, so you can spy on me and Jim in our respective man caves discussing the Second World War, usually on a Monday night, every other week. And very often with a glass of wine and guests and interaction with you, our sweet listeners. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with more Mighty 8th very soon. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.